Nuclear power and the search for life in our universe. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA's Administrator Bill Nelson is calling for a demonstration of a new type of rocket, one powered by nuclear propulsion. And while its aim is to get humans to places like Mars, some astrobiologists say it can help us search for life outside our planet. We'll hear from one scientist who hopes the technology can help us discover possible signs of life on the stuff between stars. Then we'll talk to NASA astronaut Woody Hoberg. He's the pilot of SpaceX's next Crew Dragon mission to the International Space Station. We'll hear from the first-time space flyer about his upcoming mission. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Here on 90.7 WMFE News. Before we get into the development of nuclear thermopropulsion and what that means for exploring faraway places in the search for life, let's start the show a little closer to home. NASA astronaut Woody Hoberg is a member of the Crew 6 mission launching late February on a trip to the International Space Station. Hoberg is serving as the pilot of that mission, and it will be his first trip to orbit. Before he leaves the planet, we had a chance to catch up with Hoberg from Houston, Texas. We began our conversation talking about a long-standing tradition of human spaceflight, a mission patch. What does having a crew patch mean? Does it kind of give you an emotional attachment to the mission? I mean, what does it mean to you to hold that in your hand?
Yeah, well, the crew patch is really special for so many reasons. The process of kind of pulling it together as a crew and figuring out what elements are important to us as a crew was meaningful. I think it's a chance to celebrate the teams that help us along the way. So there's some elements that kind of tie back to ground teams. And then I think it's just, it's great to have patches and be able to like hand them out to the teams that have supported us along the way. It's a little memento that we find meaningful and therefore has meaning when we hand it out to people or wear it on our patches, on our flight suits.
And what was it like holding it for the first time? I mean, I'm sure you've seen designs, but physically having it.
It's funny. We actually don't have them yet. We've seen there's samples that have gotten made, but we haven't actually received our patches yet. That should be coming very, very soon.
Okay, excellent. Another thing I want to ask you about, Woody, is you're a commercially rated pilot. You've got single and multi-engine ratings, and you're serving as pilot on this mission. But these vehicle or those vehicles are vastly different than the SpaceX Crew Dragon. Can you talk a bit about the differences in piloting a spacecraft as opposed to an aircraft that you have experience in?
Yeah, certainly. It's a great question, and it is very different. But I think there are some common threads. And so I feel very fortunate that I've been able to acquire that background. And so I think, for example, I've learned many new airplanes and the process of, your first airplane, the first airplane you fly, you learn to fly in, it's a really big deal, like learning how to do that. And then as you learn more and more airplanes, you kind of develop this process for learning the systems and learning, air speeds that you need to memorize, learning the boldface or the emergency procedures. And you just get used to this process of, well, I have this new vehicle that I'm going to be in control of. I'm going to be pilot in command. And what are the things I need to know? And how do I study to get ready for this new thing I'm learning? And so very much this is a very different type of vehicle, but I apply that same process to learning the SpaceX Crew Dragon. What's the boldface? What are the things I really need to know? What are the systems? And then also the crew resource management. So thinking about how we fly the vehicle as a crew, not just single pilot, but I'll be sitting next to Steve Bowen, and as a crew, we'll fly the vehicle. And so thinking about how we divide tasks and how we have the most situational awareness possible as an entire crew is interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think, there's lots of aviation lessons that can be applied there.
Mm-hmm. How has it been in the simulators, working on Crew Dragon with the crew? And then also, I'm under the understanding that, there's been sound that's been captured from previous missions that gets pumped into training. Like, how is it like to kind of take in the whole thing in the simulator? And do you feel ready for launch?
Yeah, the simulator out in Hawthorne is excellent. It's quite realistic. It's got not only the displays and all the software running that we interface with, but also all this kind of stowage. Like the interior of the capsule is quite realistic. We have all our firefighting equipment and our kind of emergency equipment. We're there in the seats. We can get in our suits and actually pressurize the way we would in certain emergency scenarios. So all that is quite realistic. I'd say maybe the one thing we don't get is the actual G loading, but we did have a chance to go up to the centrifuge up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and experience a full launch profile. And so I kind of keep that in the back of my mind, what I felt like at 3 Gs. And when we're in the simulator out in Hawthorne and I see 3 Gs on our G meter, I know kind of what I'm going to be feeling like. I'm going to be a little slower. Breathing's going to be a little harder. I'm not going to be quite as quick to respond to things. And I try to kind of keep that awareness in the back of my mind during training. But yeah, back to your question, Crew 5 actually expressed when they got on orbit, hey, this felt a lot like the simulator.
And that's got to be reassuring, right? As a first-time flyer to know that this is going to be a very similar experience that you're training for, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely reassuring. I think getting the repetitions is so important. You want this to be just kind of as familiar as it can be, so that when things happen on orbit, we just draw right back to those scenarios we already saw in training many, many times.
Woody, with this being your first mission to space, how are you mentally preparing for this? Have you talked to other astronauts, and how are you kind of getting in the mindset that, my goodness, in about a month I'm going to space?
Yeah, it is wild. A month from tomorrow, actually, will be our launch day. We've been really busy with training, so I think that's a large part of our preparation is just doing all the training. I have had a chance to talk to some veteran flyers, and that's been incredibly valuable. Anytime we can talk to previously flown crew members, especially about just the small differences between what we can simulate here on Earth and then kind of how it really is when you're weightless and trying to function in that microgravity environment, just the little things end up being important. And so that perspective from flown crew members has been super, super valuable.
And we know with space that, I mean, risk is low, but there's still inherent risk in space flight. How have you had been having those conversations with your family, and how do you personally prepare yourself for, the risk that is involved in space flight?
It's such a good question. I have some familiarity actually from my background in climbing with kind of those objective hazards where you prepare so much and you do everything you can in your control to minimize the risk, but then there's always little things like a rock fall out of nowhere that could get you. And so I'm kind of comfortable with that type of setting. I think I take maybe a somewhat stoic approach to it where I control the things that I can control. I prepare myself as best as I can, but I know that there's some things that are just fully outside my control. And I think, at the end of the day, what we're doing, I truly believe in. I believe in the importance of human space flight. And so I think we wouldn't be, if we weren't willing to take some risk, we wouldn't do it. But I feel that it's well worth the risk we're taking. And so I just couldn't be happier or more excited to get to participate.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Woody, thank you so much. I'm looking forward. I'm here in Orlando, so I'll be out there for your launch. Very much looking forward to watching you leave the planet. So best of luck to you and your
Oh,
crew.
that's really cool. Thanks so much. And yeah, great chatting with you.
That was NASA astronaut Woody Hoberg, pilot of SpaceX and NASA's Crew 6 mission. The mission is currently scheduled to launch no earlier than February 26 from the Kennedy Space Center. Still to come, nuclear rockets are exciting, especially those searching for life in our universe. We hear from astrobiologist Manasvi Lingam about how the development could answer one of science's biggest questions: are we alone? Are we there yet? Is back in a minute here on 90.7 WMFE News. You're listening to Are We There Yet? Here on 90.7 WMFE News. I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA wants nuclear rockets. The agency's administrator announced a partnership with DARPA for a demonstration by 2027. Simply put, nuclear-powered rockets use less mass than traditional liquid-fueled rockets. That means they can take missions farther and faster into our solar system, including humans, to Mars. But it's beyond Mars where Florida Tech's Manasvi Lingam envisions nuclear-powered missions going. He's an astrobiologist and says this technology might help us find signs of life well beyond our solar system and only take a few decades to get us there. Lingam joins us now to talk about this nuclear-powered future and the search for life. Manasvi, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for having me.
So NASA is focusing on, well, really charging the engineering community with coming up with nuclear thermo propulsion. And this is super exciting for astrobiology. We're going to get into that. But before we do that, can you just give us a quick primer? What is nuclear thermal propulsion and why is it so important?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd be happy to, Brandon. So let's first take a step. Let's take a step back and first look at how a rocket works. So a rocket works through Newton's laws. So basically what it does is it ejects a bunch of fuel out in one direction, and then that pushes the rocket forward in the opposite direction. So basically this is known as the law of conservation of momentum, and the more mass and the more amount of mass that you push out faster, the faster your rocket can move as well. So basically the whole idea of a rocket is to get a lot of mass out, and then secondly, to push it out at a very high speed. So it's the second part where nuclear thermal propulsion really shines. Because what nuclear thermal propulsion does is it takes a nuclear reactor and it uses the energy that you get from that reactor to heat the gases to a very high temperature, something like 4,500 Fahrenheit. And that particular gases are ejected out of the spacecraft at a very high speed, somewhere on the order of 10 miles per second or so, which is extremely fast. And by doing that, because you're pushing out this matter so fast, the rocket itself can begin to move at a very rapid speed. So nuclear thermal propulsion enables us to achieve pretty high speeds compared to the normal chemical rockets we use.
Mm-hmm. And essentially with the chemical rockets, as you mentioned, you have to bring a lot of mass, and that mass, it takes a lot to get it where it needs to go. And then you're limited by how much mass you can actually get up into space, right? With a nuclear thermal rocket, it's less mass and you're having more energy, right?
Yep. So if you want to get to the same final speed that you want to get to with a normal chemical rocket, you would need roughly 10 times as much mass or more compared to what you would need for a nuclear thermal rocket. So you would need to carry much less fuel to reach the same final speed for a nuclear thermal rocket.
Mm-hmm. And essentially that means you can go faster or farther in your exploration, right? With less. So this is very exciting to take things to farther places in our solar system and even beyond, right?
Yes, exactly. So you get more bang for your buck, so to speak. And that's, of course, very exciting because the thing with space is it's vast. I mean, the kind of distances we are talking about are millions of miles, billions of miles sometimes. So, to get from here to the moon, we can do that without too much issue. But even if we want to go to Mars, a lot of times the kind of normal chemical rockets we are using end up taking anywhere between 6 months to a year, whereas with nuclear propulsion, we could cut it down to a few months.
So you're cutting down the transit time. You're also able to go farther into space. That has got to be exciting for someone like you, right, Manasvi? You are an astrobiologist. You're searching for life in the universe. This opens up a whole new opportunity of places to look, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you really want to know, if you really want to answer this super fundamental question, which is, are we alone in the universe? There's only one way to do that, which is we have to go and look for it. We have to look for it through telescopes. We have to look for it by sending spacecraft to other planets and moons. So we have to go out there. So how do we do that? Well, I mean, we have chemical rockets. They're great. We've launched Voyager 1 and 2, which have gone to the very edges of the solar system. But then took a long time to get there. So whereas with this new technology, we can do the same thing in a shorter amount of time and also travel further than we've gone before.
And where would you like this to go? Of all the places in space, where should we be looking with this nuclear propulsion?
Well, I mean, hopefully one day we'll go to all the places we want to go. But you got to start somewhere. So, you know, I believe in doing things in phases, you know, one step at a time, as they say. Or, you know, they also say a baby must learn how to walk before she can run. So in the same way, I would like to first see it being deployed for Mars, because to get to the moon is not very hard, but Mars is the next target. And moreover, it's also very interesting from the standpoint of astrobiology, you know, trying to search for past life on Mars. So, you know, getting astronauts to Mars, that would be a great place to start. But after that, I want to see it go into the outer solar system, to go to the moons of Saturn and Jupiter, moons like Europa, moons like Titan, which is Saturn's moon, and so on. And maybe even further beyond in due time.
But obviously, you wrote a paper looking at an analysis of what these propulsion systems would allow astrobiologists like yourself to survey throughout these regions, including areas between stars, the space between, which, as you mentioned before, space is vast. But you're saying there's interesting things in between destinations, and that's what this technology is going to open us up to see. What is there? What could be there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So let me first start with an analogy. You know, when I was in India, let's say you hear about cities in the U.S., it's almost invariably going to be those on the East Coast or the West Coast. I myself spent time near New York City and Boston, you know, when I was at Harvard and so on. And similarly, the big cities like L.A. and so on. But then there's stuff in between. You know, we ignore many fantastic cities that exist in the Midwest, in the South, in the Southeast, and so on. So in the same way, we normally think of stars as being this the places we want to get to. So we have our solar system, then we have a different star with its own planets. But it turns out that the space between the stars actually consists of billions, trillions of small objects. Some of them are just tiny grains, so they're like microscopic, but some of them are larger, they're the size of a pebble, some are rocks, some are boulders. But then, it actually turns out, our own research has shown that there's actually a planet-sized object that are just drifting through space. They're very faint, so we don't see them, but we believe that there's potentially hundreds of them in the space between the stars, between our star and the nearest star to the sun. We think that there could be tens or hundreds of them drifting. So space is just not really empty. It has all these interesting objects drifting from all over the galaxy, just passing by. And so one of the things that I'm really interested in is trying to get to the space between the stars and then to see what's out there.
And do you think that there might be some buggers or life on those things hanging out in on these objects between the stars?
So the these objects would be, you know, let's say roughly the size of Mars or smaller. So in a lot of cases, what might happen is that the temperatures on the surface is going to be just too cold for, you know, life as we know it, because space out there is extremely cold. You know, we're talking about many hundreds below zero Fahrenheit. So incredibly cold. But the good thing is that there could be some form of life deeper underneath the surface, much as how if you dig deep below the Earth's surface, you will still find microbes and stuff. So do I think, you know, whether there could be life out there? I think it's definitely possible, you know, for microbial life, and it could be there below the surface.
So with a mission on a nuclear thermal rocket, it would be heading to a destination, right? And you're seeing these things on the way there. And with NASA Administrator Bill Nelson asking to design and demonstrate a working nuclear thermal rocket by 2027, I mean, this is coming incredibly fast when it comes to development, right? I mean, is this changing the way that astrobiologists are thinking about big questions, big research questions, hypotheses about where life may be and where we actually might be able to go in our lifetime with this technology being developed like this?
Yeah, now that's a very rapid development. So just to give you a little bit of historical context, the physical principles behind this propulsion have been understood for a long time. And by a long time, I mean we've known them for 60 years or so. But this is a welcome development, trying to actually build a prototype that actually works, and then building on that prototype to get actual spacecraft out into the solar system. So yeah, I think as our technology develops, we are definitely going to see more and more interest being shown towards targets that we previously thought were beyond our reach. For instance, some scientists have suggested there might be a Planet Nine, because Pluto got demoted from the status of a planet. And so, there might be a Planet Nine which is 10 times as far out from the sun as Pluto is. So it's way far out than Pluto, but some scientists think it's there. And if it's there, well, if you want to get to it through chemical rockets, it turns out to be really long. We are talking about 75 years or so, as my group has shown. But if you use the nuclear thermal rocket, you can do it in about 40 years, which is a big improvement given that the Voyager missions, have been running for 45 years and they're still working. So we know that we can do missions in 40 years. And imagine how cool it would be to get to, the first proper Planet Nine, and then, and we think that it might be bigger than Earth as well. So we'll be able to see a big planet out there in the outer solar system if it exists. And nuclear thermal propulsion is one particular mode of propulsion that could facilitate this particular endeavor.
That's kind of mind-blowing to think that if a Planet Nine exists with nuclear thermal propulsion, we could get there in 4 decades. That's bonkers. Like, that's not much time at all, right?
We do sometimes think it's a lot of time, but just to place it in context, I want to say that the New Horizons spacecraft, which went to Pluto, took about 11 years to get there. And this is 10 times further. So it would normally require 110 years to get there. Instead, you can collapse it down to 40 years thanks to nuclear thermal propulsion. So that's a big difference. I mean, 110 years, nobody's going to work on the mission and then live to see the end results of that mission. 40 years, it can happen. You could have a young engineer who's working on it, and then, towards the end of their career, they actually start seeing the data from them.
That's fascinating and so cool to think of that that could happen so quickly. Finally, when obviously we've been talking a lot about, especially when it comes to Mars, we're looking for, ancient signs of life on some of these bodies that may be in the space between stars. It would be deep under the surface. But you've also done a little bit of research looking into extraterrestrial intelligence, something greater than a little, a microbe or something on the surface somewhere. And you've done some research about looking at signals in space to determine whether or not those are from extraterrestrial signals or not. How do you go about finding that one spot in the vastness of space that we might want to send one of these rockets to, whether it be just to get some more observations or a signal that, hey, we're here as well? Where do we find extraterrestrial life? How do we start that? Intelligent extraterrestrial life, I should say.
So that's a great question. So, when it comes to just microbial life, we think there's many targets to look out there, even in our own solar system, such as Mars, Europa, which is Jupiter's moon, Titan, which is Saturn's moon, Enceladus, Saturn's moon, etc., etc. With extraterrestrial intelligence, we don't really have we don't really have well-defined targets yet. Instead, what we've been doing so far is to just take our telescopes, move them all across the sky, see if we pick any kind of anomalous radio signals or optical signals and so on, and then try and decode what the source of that signal might be. So this is currently where the field stands. And when it comes to, current rockets and propulsion technology, I think in the near future it's going to be useful primarily for microbial life because, again, as I said, we are currently still in the stage of only searching for, radio signals and optical signals. And if we ever get a signal one day in the future, it's going to be coming from unimaginably vast distances in all likelihood. And even the fastest rockets would not get us there on short time scale. So I think for now, in the immediate future, we will just have to focus on listening through various telescopes. The prospect of actually using a propulsion system is, you know, it's not going to be, probably not going to be very relevant in the near future, but again, in the distant future, we don't know, of course, what might happen. But even in the near future, I think that there's a lot that we can do, you know, in searching for signs of microbial life, other simple life, and so on.
I mean, going back to those signals, though, I mean, I think of radio signals like this conversation we're having is transmitted on the FM band. It's going to be out into space, but like also other objects in space create their own radio waves. So like how, and I'm going to go ahead and say that this is an intelligent conversation we're having. How would somebody outside of our planet understand that the radio waves that they're hearing is something from two beings and not, you know, some sort of star or whatever? How can we tell that it's made by an intelligent being?
Yeah. Now that's of course something that radio astronomers, I mean, in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, have been thinking about for a long time. So basically, let's say you get a radio signal and you want to know, is it something that is being artificially produced, like, you know, through intelligent beings, or is it something that just is being produced naturally due to some astronomical phenomenon? And it turns out there's several metrics we can use to diagnose one versus the other. One of them is the bandwidth. So, you know, as many of you and many of your listeners might know, we have very specific bandwidths, you know, for our radio. So we broadcast in a certain band. Whereas the thing with most astrophysical phenomena is that this energy, this radio waves, are dispersed over a very vast range of frequencies. So they're not narrow band, instead they're very, very, very broad band. And so that's one major difference. If we find some kind of unusually narrow band signal, you know, people think that that would be a good indicator of extraterrestrial intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff. Every time I chat with you, Manasvi, I have a greater appreciation of our universe and the work that astrobiologists like you are doing to uncover its secrets. So we've been speaking with Manasvi Lingam. He is an assistant professor of astrobiology at the Florida Institute of Technology. Thank you so much, Manasvi, for joining us. Always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, no. Thank you so much, Brendan, for having me. It was lovely chatting with you about all these exciting state-of-the-art developments.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online at WMFE.org. Are We There Yet? It's a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Beatrice Oliveira, and script editing this week from Danielle Pryor. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.